quorum sitting down. So we've heard about honoring the past, and we've heard about navigating the present, so now we're going to chart the future. In the past, and in the present, the PRO Consortium's mission has been to develop PRO instruments for qualification, and PRO is patient-reported. However, in the future, the patient may not necessarily be the respondent. So in keeping that in mind, our last session of the day will be developing pediatric COA measurement strategy, a case study in asthma. And our moderator is Liz Pierre-Louis, and I'll turn it over to her.
Good afternoon. So as a French, I'm uniquely qualified to stand between you and a glass of wine, so please bear with us. Although CPAS has been primarily focusing on developing instruments that are completed by adults, CPAS has already been extremely interested in and dedicated to advance the field of measurement in pediatric population. So we started the discussion, in fact, 2 years ago with a nice talk between Donald Patrick and Linda Abetz, and they shared with us the difficulties interviewing pediatric patients. Last year, we discussed the challenges of implementing a PRO strategy in patients who are cognitively impaired and also young. So you will see that it's becoming an habit with this session that, in fact, we have more questions than solutions. But we are here, and we are extremely pleased to have this large audience and to pick up your brains and discuss all those relevant issues regarding pediatric assessment. So with me, I have a very distinguished panel of experts, Linda Nelson, who is the co-chair of the asthma working group. I have Dr. Masta, who has been leading the development of the eSport task force on pediatric assessment. I have Dr. Arbuckle, who has more than 10 years of experience with pediatric assessment. Dr. Johnson, a statistician from NIH, who is going to help us understand how we can develop endpoints for pediatric assessment. And at last but not at least, we have our distinguished colleagues from FDA, Dr. Mühlberg, Dr. Sachs, and Dr. Papadopoulos, who are going to share with us the FDA perspectives. So we will try to be on time, so please ask your questions, share your experience in a timely fashion. Thank you so much.
Good afternoon. I think it will be a challenge to meet up to all the wonderful sessions we've had already. We'd like this to be very interactive, so we have a few words to start, and some of the panelists will speak, but then we also want to have interaction with the audience throughout. So let me just give you a little perspective on where we're coming from and why we feel the need to keep talking about pediatrics. So these are two example asthma labels. These drugs have both been on the market for 15 or 20 years. They're two very commonly used asthma drugs in pediatrics. I'll keep them anonymous, you can probably guess. So asthma drug 1 is approved for patients aged 4 years and older. Asthma drug 2 is indicated for prophylaxis and chronic treatment of asthma in children 12 months and older. But when we look back at the clinical studies that support the registration of these trials, for asthma drug 1, the primary objective was to determine the safety of the drug, and it also included a secondary efficacy measure of pulmonary function. But it wasn't telling us directly very much about the clinical impact of this drug on children. For asthma drug 2, they actually had a primary objective of lung function, but again, no primary or even key secondary objectives around the clinical impact of asthma in these children. And in the youngest age group, 2 to 5, they only looked at the safety and tolerability. And when we go look at how the drugs are labeled and approved, for asthma drug 1, they extrapolated the efficacy from adults and children 12 years and older and assumed it would be efficacious in younger children, ages 4 to 11. And similarly for asthma drug 2, exploratory efficacy evaluations support an overall conclusion that it's efficacious. But we don't have any direct understanding of how these drugs really impact symptoms that are experienced by children. So the asthma working group is actually one of the first working groups that got moving in the PRO consortium. And back in 2010, this was back before the DDT process, so we sent in the scoping summary document back in July 2010. And we got a response from our qualification review team that said, yeah, symptoms are really important. We probably know how to measure adult symptoms, but we really want you to think about coming up with symptom measures for children because we don't understand how to do that, and we think it's a really important issue. It's really important, great clinical significance, and there's no uniform regulatory pathway. We had a little discussion, and it was agreed that perhaps we did need to measure adult asthma symptoms, but they again reiterated, we strongly recommend you include age-appropriate asthma sinus symptom assessment measures in children 11 years of age and younger. And it's unclear if an instrument that's developed for adults is going to be appropriate for adolescents. So really make sure that the qualitative research is going to address adolescents. They may report their asthma symptoms differently. They may experience them differently. We're moving along. We're in a very good place. We have a developed instrument. We're about to launch into our quantitative research phase. And when we submitted our qualitative research proposal, again, the FDA endorsed, you're right, asthma symptoms is an important tool, but we want you to expand your scope to deal with this really important public health priority, which is age-appropriate symptom measures for a pediatric population age 11 years and younger. So the regulators certainly are asking us very directly to move this forward. So what we'd like to do in this session is go back and think sort of in three topics along the patient-focused roadmap of how to address pediatric issues. So first, how do we begin to understand the disease? And we've addressed this a little bit in previous sessions where we talked about concept elicitation. But again, going back and thinking about how do you differentiate the disease in children compared to adults? Are differences due to a truly different disease experience or different in the child's perception or different in the child's ability to articulate how they experience the disease? In terms of conceptualizing treatment benefit, we're focusing on a question of how do you begin to define the treatment benefit when you may have different reporters? You may have an observer of signs for a very young child. You may have self-report for an older child. And how do you conceptualize that treatment benefit in a consistent way to support a drug development program? And finally, when you select a measure, how do you begin to conceptualize an endpoint that's meaningful across age ranges and across the disease over these ages? So with that, I'll ask Dr. Mazza to come up to summarize where we are in terms of pediatric measurement development through the ISPOR Task Force.
There we go. Hello, thanks for staying this late. Some of you look tired. I'll try to wake you up. My name is Louis Mazza. I work as a senior research scientist at Evidera in Bethesda, Maryland, just about 5 or 6 miles from here, so you can come visit if you're still in town tomorrow. And I'm here to introduce some of the unique challenges. Linda asked me to introduce some of the issues that must be considered when developing or implementing PRO measures with children, and with a specific focus on using these measures in the regulatory context. The work and recommendations that I'll be describing are based on the work of this task force convened for ISPOR, the International Society for Pharmacoeconomics and Outcomes Research. And the task force included members with expertise in pediatrics and PRO research, chosen to represent a range of backgrounds and disciplines, including academia, the pharmaceutical industry, and the FDA. I was the chair of the group, and the co-chair is Donald Patrick, the good-looking young man in the second row right there. And I should also acknowledge our 5 additional co-authors right here, who are listed on this page. I won't read all their names, but all of them made significant contributions to the content and recommendations included in this task force report, which I'll be summarizing today. In addition, the task force report was revised and refined several times based on reviews by a wide range of people from academia, from industry, from various regulatory authorities. So it does represent a pretty broad consensus of people thinking about what the major issues in pediatric PRO assessment might be. And I should also say the task force report was published last year in Value and Health, so you can get it right now. It's no longer confidential. Okay. And I know you're all familiar with the FDA PRO guidance, and this guidance document, it has a brief paragraph consisting of 12 lines of text. For those of you who want to look it up, it's section Roman numeral 3.G.1. And this brief section is on children, and it says, issues related to the development process for pediatric PRO instruments are similar to the issues detailed for adults. The guidance then adds that when using these measures or developing measures for children, there are additional issues not faced in research with adults, and several challenges are briefly mentioned. But these challenges are not described in any detail because the purpose of this document was a broad overview of PROs, not a focus on pediatrics. So what our task force set out to do was to examine these specific child-focused challenges in a more detailed manner. So here are the objectives. The objective was to suggest good practices for pediatric PRO research conducted to inform regulatory decision-making and support claims made in medical product labeling. As much as possible, we based our recommendations on published research. However, empirical research, as you might guess, is limited in some important areas of instrument design, development, validation, and implementation with children. Therefore, we had the secondary purpose, which was to highlight areas where further research on pediatric PROs is needed. And I should also say that methods for pediatric PRO measures have been reviewed and discussed in many previous publications, and there are also papers that have great lists of child-specific measures that you can use. And where we differed from all of these previous articles is that we were focused on the regulatory context, this issue of how to implement these measures when thinking about medical product development and labeling. So the paper is organized into five sections corresponding to five areas of good practice, and I'll briefly introduce each topic. Unfortunately, each is quite detailed and complicated, so I'm just going to introduce it to give you a sense of the kinds of things we were considering and the kinds of things the panel might be discussing and the kinds of questions you might want to ask. But if you'd like more details, I recommend checking out the paper. Okay. So first, developmental appropriateness is a key issue in PRO research with children and one of the most difficult issues. I get a lot of phone calls from coworkers saying, I have to develop this new measure. Can you tell me at what age can children begin to report their health status? When are children's responses reliable? I have this sample of 11-year-olds, but I want to use a questionnaire that's designed for 12 to 18-year-olds. Is that okay? And of course, all of my friends want answers that sound something like six, or yes, or no. Sadly, I always end up feeling woefully inadequate because my answer is always, it depends. It depends. And so still, it is possible to provide some useful guidance for these sorts of specific questions based on published literature, and that's what we tried to do. So we did a very thorough review of the literature, and we also argued a lot on the telephone, and we ended up proposing these age groupings that you can use as a starting point when trying to answer these age-related questions. And these groupings are primarily based on thorough review of pediatric PRO research, but also group consensus. So here are the four age groups. You could look at those for a second. And each of these groups is discussed in detail in the paper. And as I'm sure you would expect, there's a substantial body of research suggesting that the ability to reliably complete a PRO measure improves as children get older. And you can see that in the middle column here. So under five, I was unable to find any evidence of reliability and validity with true child report measures. But the evidence improves as children get older. And interestingly, somewhere around age eight, I don't know why, but we kept seeing that arise over and over in publications. There seems to be this point where there's more data showing reliable responses from children. And of course, that's very variable, so I'm not telling you that children should report starting at age eight, but there did seem to be a turning point around there in the literature. So when developing new PRO instruments or using existing instruments, it's critical to demonstrate the age appropriateness of the instrument for the target population. And age appropriateness, as I'm sure you can guess, should be documented with a combination of quantitative and qualitative research. And both of these kinds of research should be conducted with children in the target population. So if it has been shown to be valid in 11-year-old or in 12-year-olds, it's not necessarily valid in 11-year-olds. You would want to check that out. Okay. Good practice two, establishing content validity of pediatric PROs. And I think since you've all been sitting here all day, I know that you know what content validity is, and I'm not going to read that first bullet point to you. But to support the use of a PRO measure for medical product labeling, evidence documenting content validity is required, and this is true for pediatric measures as well. And the evidence is established via these two steps of qualitative research with direct input from the target population. And I know you know these two steps, concept elicitation and cognitive interviews, so we'll go through them very quickly. So in the past, and you can find a lot of published articles showing this, in the past, content validity of child instruments was often supported through concept elicitation work in interviews and focus groups conducted with parents or with clinicians. And most of the instruments that I looked at over the past 20 years, when you looked at the method section in the small print, it said, we came up with the items by talking to pediatricians and parents. And there were not that many that actually talked to children, unfortunately. And however, there is this growing body of literature now suggesting that children can be very helpful at this stage. And despite the fact that it's often a hassle to publish a qualitative article, there are now some qualitative studies published using child participants to try to identify important content for PRO measures. And we consider that a step in a nice direction. So we believe that children and adolescents can be effective content experts who can provide useful information in this process, and we're advocating for them to be included. So as with adults, you can gather these data in interviews, individual interviews, or in focus groups. I guess I should warn you that focus groups with children may have specific challenges different from those with adults. And it's late in the day, so I'll tell you that I learned this the hard way last week when I volunteered to read aloud in my daughter's kindergarten class. I went armed with my favorite book, and not my favorite children's book, my favorite book, The Snail and the Whale. And which is, it's an inspirational tale of a tiny snail that saves the life of a humpback whale. And I expected to go in armed with this material and to have the room eating out of the palm of my hand. And that was true for about 15 of the kids. There were another 5 who were much more interested in the fact that the person next to them might have been touching them, or that they, you know, their hair was out of place, or I don't know, whatever it was. But so it alerted me to the challenges of dealing with a large group of children in a room together, because some of them are somewhat distractible. And so again, just focus groups with children, interviews with children are not the same as those with adults. In our paper, we highlight a list of these ways that they may be different, and it's great to think through these things before you start your work. Also, during concept elicitation, we recommend collecting data from several types of respondents, including the children themselves, parents, and clinicians, because each of these people may bring a unique perspective, and they each have the ability to observe different aspects of the child's behavior in different contexts, and it will help you understand the broader perspective of the child's disease and treatment and the impact of these things. Okay. So you've created your measure based on your concept elicitation work, and now you administer the measure and you conduct your cognitive interviews. And this is a great opportunity to check that developmental appropriateness that we talked about earlier. In this cognitive interview procedure, you can take the time to examine how the measure works in children of various ages and watch how they respond, ask for their descriptions of what the items mean to them, and you can drill down and figure out how children of different ages are likely to perceive and understand your questionnaire. We believe that these cognitive interviews should be conducted with respondents from the target population. So if it's a child report measure, you should not conduct these interviews with parents. You should actually have the child complete the measure and ask the child what they think. And it's a challenging task for children. They're not used to being considered the expert of questionnaire design, but hopefully you can at least try. Okay, good practice three, determining whether an informant report outcome is necessary. We use this word informant reported outcome. We debated for a long time about what this word should be. We thought informant could have some negative connotations. We don't mean it as negative at all. It's not like a tattletale or anything like that. So informant reported outcomes may be necessary when children are not able to complete PRO measures on their own because of language limitations, developmental stage, illness severity, cognitive ability, or any other reason. And the key to this term informant reported outcome measure is that it includes both observational measures, which people often call OBSROs these days, and proxy measures, as you can see in this little flowchart here. And the informant might be a parent, most frequently a parent, but could also be a clinician, a teacher, or anyone else who knows the child, another caregiver perhaps. So let me just talk about the difference between observational and proxy measures for a second. Observational measures are those where the items assess only directly observable behavior. So these are things that the parent or the reporter can see, hear, or otherwise perceive directly. Proxy measures are those that require the respondent to in some way interpret or read into the child's behavior. Surprisingly, most of the measures that we have in the literature do have proxy content in them. There are not many truly observational measures available. So now, here's why this is important, because data contributing to regulatory decision making and medical product labeling, as you know, must be as unambiguous and clear as possible. And therefore, the FDA PRO guidance says that informant measures should be observational rather than proxy. And so parent-reported measures are likely to be most reliable, most valid, most accurate when the parents are reporting on something that they've actually seen. Even then, it's a challenge to get reliability sometimes, right? But if they're reporting on something they've heard from somebody else or something they're assuming based on a guess about what the child might be thinking or feeling, it's a real challenge to get that response to be reliable and to know what you're actually assessing. So therefore, this task force agrees with the recommendations of the FDA for research conducted in the regulatory context. And here's our three recommendations. I'll summarize. When children in the target age range are generally capable of reliably reporting the domains of interest, a child-reported measure should be used. I think there's the least interference between the child's experience and your data if you take that approach. When children are not capable, an informant-reported measure may be used. And when using an informant-reported measure, items should assess observable content as much as possible. Good practice four. Appropriate instrument design and formatting for the target age group. And now we discuss a range of these aspects of instrument design and formatting. These are the sort of practical things you have to think about when designing a child measure. And there's a wide range of these. And there's some literature on every one of them if you want to go looking at our paper or reviewing the literature. Here's one example, children's health-related vocabulary. And like many abilities, this ability improves with age. I like this particular study, the Reebok et al. Study from 2001. It demonstrates this very nicely. They have this long list of health-related terms, and they figured out at these various ages, 5, 6, 7, and 8, what percentage of children had a good understanding of each term. And let's just look at the dotted line for energy. You can look, energy is the line with the little dots. And at age 5, they found that only about 56 or 57% of the kids had a good understanding of the term, compared with over 90% at age 8. So this is just one of the things you have to think about. Here's a list of other things you have to think about for child measures. I guess I won't go into each of these. Time is short. But one of them that's an area of great debate is the 1, 2, 3, 4th bullet point, pictorial representations. A lot of child measures use these creative pictorial representations. Some are pictures, some are smiley faces, some are circles of graduated sizes, some are, it's a wide variety, some are colors. And these are actually quite complicated. And the way children interpret these pictures and your circles of graduated sizes and the smiley faces might be very different from how you intend for them to be interpreted. So every little detail like this should be checked in your cognitive interviewing, and even the little smiley faces. Okay. Next, cross-cultural issues. Consider cross-cultural issues. This is our fifth good practice. And of course, you do this for adults as well. But there could be some issues that are different for pediatric samples. For example, let's look at the middle of the three bullet points I have here. There are cultural differences in the type of information that is conveyed to children about disease and treatment. In some cultures, you may speak with children openly, in others, you might hide information from them. And that suggests that a measure that might be useful in one culture may not get valid responses in a culture where children are not given the information that they need to adequately answer the items. So therefore, we recommend that content validity and measurement properties may need to be re-examined when applying a pediatric instrument in a new culture. Okay, conclusions. I see my 2-minute mark is up, so it's good that I'm at the conclusions here. The recommendations we provide should not be interpreted as concrete rules that you should follow in every situation. We're not providing any sort of strict guidance like that. Instead, for each individual study, the optimal PRO approach will depend on a range of factors, including the child's age, the medical condition of the target population, and the constructs being assessed. And therefore, what we aim to do is provide some general guidance and discuss the issues to help researchers through this process of figuring out how they think they should best assess these constructs in children. I should point out that different PRO approaches may be advisable for research that is not intended to support medical product labeling or regulatory decisions. For example, many of the proxy measures out there are great instruments and may be very useful in situations where that don't have such a high bar for absolute certainty and decision making. Finally, while there is empirical research supporting many of our recommendations, further research is needed in most areas. And I've listed some of these areas here, and I anticipate we'll be talking about these over the next 40 minutes or so. Maybe I'll just highlight a couple of them. I'll highlight the bottom two. How about that? What about interpretation of data from multiple reporters? Very often, with children, you do have multiple reporters, and it's complicated to figure out how to interpret that data. Perhaps one should be the primary reporter, or what do you do when the reporters disagree, when there are contradictions? Finally, multiple age groups. A lot of child measures have different forms for different age groups, and combining across those forms, if they have different response scales or especially different content, can be very complicated. So a lot of questions here, and we'll get to these soon. Finally, there's a citation for the paper, so if your imagination has been sparked and you want more detail, you can find it. Okay, next.
Thank you so much for this summary of this very important publication. So we would like to